Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Parmenides of Ella, a reading from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Now, there's Thales and the very early Pythagoras, and then you've got Plato and Socrates, that school. He slots in at a very interesting point of history preceding these people. And you'll hear a bit about how we wrote his philosophy and how we've understand him. So he's in the very cusp of our consciousness of philosophy. I've been interested in reading philosophers to you and looking at it as an extension. So the combination of philosophy that we look at the moment is a sort of combination of what we call almost archaeology, going back into the time and reconstructing the knowledge. We don't have the actual knowledge in front of us. And this changes over time. Up until our modern time, our modern philosophy, and we sort of put aside the discipline of the archaeology or reconstructing the culture or the community around a philosophy, how it's gone ahead. So that's something which has attracted me at this point in time, applying the principles of looking back in philosophy to our current time to work out the implications of our philosophy and what our philosophy tells us about our community and alternatives to going forward. But I'll read through this and get to you. This is sort of interrupting in the middle of podcasts I'm doing about technetium scans and brain scans and various other things like this. But let's read about this. This is Parmenides, and so he's strangely from when Greece expanded to Italy. So in the early Roman, also before the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire flourished, Bronze Age, not necessarily, well, it's hard to say, I don't think they're Iron Aged. Bronze Age, and they have colonies on southern Italy through Sicily, and that's actually part of Greece. They're Greek speaking, and Rome has wars eventually to keep them off the Italian peninsula. But there's a lot of creative philosophers occur on the Greek extension. So you've got the centralized Greek society. And eventually that has a philosophy schools, the Academy of Plato. But there's this time in ancient history where philosophy is all happening on the exteriors. It's a bit like the modern day where we look for Hollywood or to the new world of the Americas for leadership. And they definitely are coming up with some ideas. So let's read about and we'll discuss it importantly. The big overview I find interesting about him is that back in the day there was no journals, publications, philosophy wasn't actually known. And so people, when they have ideas, were looking for a place to put them. And he put them in poetry and religious poems. Discussion or the cultural community of understanding to do with philosophy was bound with religion. He wrote a religious poem, and people's participation with religion was such that philosophy could develop. It was actually a not something dead, which actually just gave out information. It was something that people actively participated in developing and interpreting, which is slightly different from us nowadays. Then a bit later on, Plato wrote a series of plays or film scripts in which he wrote his philosophy. Again, he didn't have a journal or a book to produce it in. And then you have Aristotle, who begins to produce generalized books. So you can see philosophy and the culture to absorb it is slowly switching on. We're looking at here. But then again, nowadays, we have a situation where our modern analysis of philosophy has to advance. And I've been looking, thinking and looking about this. Let's start reading this. And it's Parmenides. P-A-R-M-E-N-I-D-E-S. Parmenides. Parmenides of Ella, active in the earliest part of the 5th century BCE, authored a difficult metaphorical and metaphysical poem that has earned him a reputation as an early Greek philosophy's most profound and challenging thinkers. So what did he do? He wrote a single, very big poem. It's a metaphysical poem. So now you have to understand that the Greek culture or story was criticisms was in the form of plays and poems and scripts. There was no treatise or books on philosophy because that wasn't an area. So they were struggling. And back they're saying here that he wrote a single poem. But the poem was so profound that he's been identified as a thinker. But as you'll see, there's other ways we know of him. His philosophical stance has typically been understood as one of extremely paradoxical and yet crucially for broad development of Greek natural philosophy and metaphysics. So there is this paradox school. And it is often a stage, a very necessary stage, where you have this something called cognitive dissonance in education or in PhDs. You have something and it doesn't make sense. And what happens is you transition from sort of the crowd, it doesn't make sense, forget it, move on, nothing to see here, it doesn't make sense. I'm going to find out. It's that mezzanine step. So it may be paradoxical, but it's philosophy. Doesn't necessarily mean that that's a way of going forward. He's been seen as metaphysical monist, one stripe of another, who so challenged the naive cosmological theories of his predecessors that his major successes among pre-Socratics were all driven to develop more sophisticated physical theories in response to his arguments. So, monos is, I don't know whether this is God, it's the monad. It's something which I'm truly trying to understand. So the monad was developed by Pythagoras, and it was a simple dot with a circle drawn around it, and that created a philosophical school of monadism, which wound eventually up in Leibniz, a modern philosopher who developed calculus and digital theory that we're on. And he would have the dot, it's either a digital dot. Basically, he started off with the bit. And he, Pythagoras, 700, a few hundred years before, Parmenides drew a dot in the sand, put a circle around it, and that has become the symbol of knowledge, and it's really gone. So this is sort of knowledge as a separate idea from spirits, sort of. So it's sort of an interesting thing to get in. I still fully haven't understood it. The arguments, when you follow it and read it, okay, there's a thing where people can explain it, but when you actually read some of the stuff from Leibniz or the later things, you can see how it leads to our modern era. But you can also see that it doesn't quite make sense. So eventually, using his monadism, Leibniz writes down a series of statements which are directly contradicted by quantum mechanics. But in a sense, that doesn't really prove anything. But it's really interesting to look at. So monads, pre-Socratics is from Socrates, so the people leading up to Socrates, are trying to develop a non-spiritual knowledge definition of the world. I suppose this is what it says. Difficulties involved in the interpretation of his poem resulted in disagreement about many fundamental questions concerning his philosophical views, such as whether he actually was a monist, and if so, what kind of monist was he? Whether his system reflects a critical attitude towards earlier thinkers, such as Malthusians and Pythagoreans, and Heraclitus, or whether he was motivated simply by more strictly logical concerns such as the paradox of negative essentials that Bertrand Russell detected at the heart of his thought, whether he considered the world of our everyday awareness with its vast population of entities changing and affecting one another in all manners of ways to be simply an illusion, and thus whether the lengthy cosmological portion of his poem represented a genuine attempt to understand this world at all. So there's a lot here. If you've just listened to that, I've mentioned the Pythagoreans. I don't know about the Malthusians or the Heraclitus, so I'll have a look at that. I don't know what negative essentials actually means, so I'll have to get in and understand this. But I do understand a bit about monists where this is sort of like the fundamental theory of knowledge, and it's pretty interesting that at the very start of history, mathematics, before we really got into number, we drew the bit, the digital bit, and how it's come to be. It's a lovely story, at least. So what exactly is a monist? So I know a monist is someone who discusses the monad, and this is the essence of number. And so it's essentially using logic. And so before this, philosophers didn't necessarily try to use logic. And so he's written a poem. The poem's lost. Lots of people looked at it, and we've got to do work out what's the paradox of negative essentials. Bertrand Russell is an English logician, and he's developed by a mathematical language of logic. So he's a mathematician, and he converted philosophical arguments into logical language, so he could write down philosophical arguments as equations, and he did a big work in this. And again, I'll have to look at the theory of Bertrand Russell, but a very important philosopher. I think Bertrand Russell is a modern person. I think he was around sufficiently to be an anti-nuclear protester, so that gives you that that idea of where he's at. But it's all very very interesting. So this entry aims to provide an overview of Parmenides' work and some of the major interpretive approaches advanced over the past few decades, and concludes by suggesting understanding of his thought and his place in the development of early Greek philosophy requires taking due account of the fundamental modal distinctions that he was first to articulate and explore with any precision. So, well, let's see if we'll understand what that means in terms of modal, what it means by modal interpretation. But he lists, well, I can see at this stage that he's like, if you look at all of human history as a huge PhD thesis, this is basically the first literature review that he's doing, and he's coming up with paradoxes and questionings, beginning to define things. So he's a very important thing, because a philosopher like Socrates and Plato, Plato came after Socrates, that's formed the modern structure of philosophers. There are various people who are Neoplatonists, and they have a big battle with Newton, who famously said, I feign no hypothesis. Newton just did description and really set the world on fire. And so to try and unstick what's coming along, the sort of the battle with the rationalists, you really have to go back and nail this person, Parmenides, and the fact that people sort of get culturalized, that I've read my first philosophy of books, and when you go back to a philosopher who hasn't written a book, hasn't written a poem, people just say, oh, well, I'm No, I won't do it. Which is indeed a very interesting sort of development in our philosophical understanding, in that we have a society which simply will not listen to its past. That's my view, that we live in a society which doesn't listen to its past. I think that's one thing you could say about us. We like to watch plays and reconstructions of it, but we actually don't go back to the past and actually recreate, do our archaeology. We like watching documentaries, but we actually don't like rolling up our sleeves and going into the digs and working out what's going on. Session 1, Life and Writings. The dramatic occasion of Plato's dialogue, Parmenides, is a fictionalized visit to Athens of this eminent Parmenides and his younger associate Zeno to attend the festival of the great Panathenaea. Okay, now let's go back and stop at this point here. So Plato wrote these dialogues, which are basically filmed. We'd recognize them as play scripts or film scripts, and he would write them. So back in the day, you could go and see a play, or you could actually, if you really wanted to, read a play script. And yeah, I suppose it was slightly different things. And he wrote, Plato wrote, I don't know off the top of my head, roughly 30 play scripts. One of them was, I suppose, the Republic. There's ones that I really want to get back and read from end to end. And because they're play scripts and they're plays, people think he was talking in parables, but that's really not it. He would construct an entire scene, so it would be a parable, as in any play is a parable, is a representation of life as we want it. And so one of his books is actually this philosopher, and he writes about this philosopher, about what this philosopher said, and so some of it may be legitimate about what he says, but it's also Plato's interactions, his discussion. So it's a very powerful way of quickly getting thoughts down in a world where there is no internet, there is no libraries, there's no scholarship, you can get down. Now Zeno's paradox is the fact that I think it's Achilles or some athlete and the tortoise, and he was looking at infinitesimals, and it's essentially the world before calculus. And so a world without calculus, the athlete will never beat the turtle, because if you think about it, if you're thinking about him getting closer and closer, that is a shorter and shorter amount of time, delta t mathematically, and this is just a mathematical function they didn't have. And so Zeno had a paradox that you would never, the athlete would never get past the turtle. This is a sort of paradox because it contradicts our common understanding. And of course at this stage it's sort of a big view into it, that people didn't think, oh, this doesn't make sense, or maybe the logic has to change. They had these schools, so Zeno's paradox. So there's this play that Plato wrote. So Plato is Socrates' student, and he is in the academy in Athens. That's Plato's in Athens. Parmenides is has lived before Plato and is in Sicily, and he's doing a fictionalized visit to, I suppose it'd be Athens. A visit to Athens. So it's sort of like a brings these concepts into people. And so one of the great things about plays is that everyone's invited. Everyone is, there's no, you have to be an academic to view this. Now, here's just to give you a bit of background of the academy. The academy was a house, the house of Academus, and he was a person who used logic to avoid a war with Sparta. And so the Athenians, who were, I don't know, a pretty rotten group as far as I'm concerned, you know, if you really think about them, they said, we don't know what this logic stuff is, but it's certainly great. Here, have a house for life, academus, and here's your house, and it's going to be a house that we will fund indefinitely for thinkers. Thanks a lot, mate. And of course, they had nothing more to it. They didn't know what it was going to produce, and it's produced Socrates and Plato and stuff like that. Okay. Plato describes Parmenides as about 65 years old, as Socrates, with whom he converses in the first part of the dialogue, was quite young then, which is normally taken to mean about 20. Okay, so this means that Parmenides has died, and Socrates, now an old man, now he's remembering a fictionalized account of this person coming in. So this is very hard to do. Now what happens is that your classic person who's reading the truth and the truth of the world, or world news, I've got all those trashy papers, it's either true and then it's factional, or you throw it out. This idea of throwing out ideas. And so a lot of people throwing these ideas out because, oh, it's not true, but this is the best we've got. Given that Socrates was a little past 70 when he was executed, oh yes, also this is going back, so Plato is Plato is remembering his teacher, who is remembering a time 50 years back, so this gives you the idea of where Parmenides is. Okay, given that Socrates was a little past 70 when he was executed by the Athenians in 399 BCE, one can infer from this description that Parmenides was born about 515 BC. Now, this is, of course, these are negative numbers, the dates go backwards, or the numbers get bigger negative as you go further backwards. Now, Socrates essentially wasn't executed, he was told to commit suicide. And he committed suicide because it was a logical, political statement to do. It's a very interesting thing to read. So Socrates reasoned to disprove someone. He had to commit suicide. And so he did. He took hemlock. It was a very sort of Christ, it's like a prequel of Christ. It's very interesting about, Socrates being great and Christ being great by the same sort of overall sequence. The actual story is different, but the key chapters are pretty much the same. And it sort of means that it disposed, he's sort of, the death of Socrates predisposed or modified the ancient world such that when Christ died, he was more successful. He would thus appear to have been active during the mid 5th century BCE. So that's all we know. We can use writings that we can use from this play, Parmenides. We know about him from his. Sepis, Plato's successor as the head of the academy, is said to have reported in his On Philosophers that Parmenides established the laws for the citizens of his native Elam, once Greek colonies along southern Italy's Trihelian coast. Okay, so there's this house in Greece called the House of Academos, so it's the academy, and the person after Plato is Sepicianus, but he is beginning to write, after Plato, books, specifically what we would recognise as textbooks or journals. And after that, I think there's Aristotle. This person is writing a bit of background on the philosophers. So they've got this knowledge of them, they have books on it. And these philosophers were important as leaders, so they were pretty much leaders and lawmakers, and you have Pythagoras having a cult of mathematics cults. This person also had some sort of cult, so it's hard to understand. You must also understand that the Greek ship would come, the Greek ship would go, and then it would be deathly quiet. There'd be just wolves in the hills, bears about the place, raiding people, and you'd establish this need for Greek life, and of course it sort of regenerated, rebirthed. That's my view of it, at least. And so this is, Greek is expanded, but it sort of puts things out, and it's almost like putting a Greek germ in a petri dish and seeing what's going on. Although Ella was founded some 30 years before Pyramid's birth, so Ella, these are sort of like towns, like settlements on the West Bank or something like that. The ancient historiographic tradition naturally associates Pyramids with thinkers such as Xenophanes and the Pythagoreans active in Magna Graecia, the Greek-speaking regions of South Italy. So Xenophanes, Xenophanes. Now, I'll have to look up who Xenophanes is. Okay, so this person is incredibly important. The other people, Pythagoras is Pythagoras because he's left so strongly in mathematics, we know a bit about, but Xenophanes, who he is, I'll have to do. He may well have encountered. So he was at the same time of Pythagoras, so he may have met Pythagoras and Xenophanes. A first century portrait of the head that's first century AD portrait of the head of Pyramides was discovered in Castellammare della Brucca, ancient Ella, in the 1960s with the inscription. The city that we have now is Castellammare della, so it means Castle of the Sea of Brucia, ancient Ella, so Ella no longer exists, and it's a thing, it would be logical that you'd find his head. And the inscription on the statue says, Pyramides, son of Pyrrhus, Oeades, natural philosopher. That associates him with the cult of Apollo Olus, or Apollo the healer. So he's the son of God. So this is the entire thing, is that you'd have this upper class thing, and the slaves are going, shall we revolt? Why did you kill me? Why did you do that? Well, I've got a different moral code. I've got the God code. And it's very interesting that religions still have this, modern day religions, like the Catholic religions, have a slightly different moral code for priests and within their own society, as opposed for the rest of us. It's this association with God, which goes through and says things. According to Diogenes, Laertius, okay, so this is not our famous Diogenes, this is another person, Pyramides composed only a single work. This was a metaphysical, cosmological poem in the traditional epic medium of hexameter verse. You have to really understand that poetry and plays were really alive in the Greek world. So if they didn't want a battle, they would send a bard out, and these bards would sing poems, and people gather around, and it was basically their internet or political advertising was doing this. And this is still forward, or even up to the time of Newton, at 6, when was Principia written, but Principia has a poem in front of it. So now, if you, what is interesting, if you mention to a modern day English teacher in the New South Wales system about poetry, these ancient poems and the interaction between philosophy, poetry, mathematics and poetry, and the fact that the famous scientists wrote poems and stuck it in front of their books, they literally, I can still see them in their face turning up in their nose, you're an idiot, I dislike you, I'll ensure that you go under for giving me some facts which I don't believe in. But it is true that these philosophers did write in poems. And this is, I suppose, a reflect for you, that you're finding out about this, that this early philosopher only wrote in poems, Plato only wrote in film scripts or play scripts. The profound lack of understanding of the people in education is just stunning, but it is also interesting as a sort of neo or contemporary archaeology to work out what does this behaviour, what does this tell us about the culture. The title, On Nature, that's the name of the poem. He had one poem called On Nature, under which it was transmitted, is probably not authentic. Oh, so someone stuck On Nature on the top. The poem originally extended to perhaps 800 verses, roughly 160 of which have survived as fragments that vary in length from a single word, water-rooted, describing the earth, to 62 verses of fragment 8. So, really, it really is an archaeological dig, isn't it? That any portion of his poem survives is due entirely to the fact that later ancient authors, beginning with Plato, for one reason or another, felt the need to quote some portions of it in the course of their own writing. So they had it there, and they would just fill this in as background. So it's sort of like people having a lost thing, and the film producer had an authentic thing as a prop. And archaeologists now say, well, watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, because that covenant is the actual real covenant. Sextus Empiricus quotes 30 of the 32 verses of fragment 1, the opening poem, a proem of the poem. So I believe a proem is like an introduction part of the poem. So this, you've got a poem, and P-R-O-E-M is the start. Although apparently from some sort of Hellenistic digest rather than from the actual manuscript copy, for his quotation continues uninterrupted with 5.5 verses of fragments 7 and 8. So what happens is that people are doing a digest, and isn't it beautiful coming across, and they're saying, oh well, no, this is segment 1, but you put in other segments in here. Isn't that beautiful? So we're a real archaeologist. The Alexandrian Neoplatonist, Platonus Simplicus, the 6th century CE. So there's a guy called Simplicus, which is really interesting because that's the name of Galileo's simple guy. But and so simple means full, thus it can mean full. It did unfortunately translate badly for Galileo. So Alexandria is the port in the mouth of the Nile before it was completely stuffed. And Neoplatonus means that this is Plato's school. So Plato's school was basically had a theory of forms, sort of idea, conceptual world, and that we're all inside the mind of God. We're sort of like inside the matrix. And this is true. This is the idea of the matrix is a Platonic view. And so the idea of forms, the ideal of a form. Now, as I read about this, my poor brain is racking to try and keep up with all of this. Appears to have possessed a good copy of the work from which he quotes extensively in his commentaries on Aristotle's Physics and De Callio. So Aristotle wrote two books, the Physics and De Callio. Now, notice at this stage that Aristotle, many centuries later, is writing books on a topic. Because the topic, this guy is writing a poem on it. And he's got the Physics and the poem. Physics and the poem, and so he's writing a commentary on it. Simplicus is writing a poem in the 6th century CE. He introduces his lengthy quotation as follows. Even one might think it pedantic, I would gladly transcribe this commentary, the verses of Parmenides on the one of being, which aren't numerous, but as evidence for what I have said, and because of the scarcity of Parmenides' treatises. So, this person had the real copy, and the copies are now burnt. I think you've got the burning of the... Now remember, the Christians destroyed a lot of the ancient knowledge. They came in, although everyone says that it's put in monasteries, they were real people. Early Christians were not very much unlike ISIS. They would burn ancient symbols. They actually massacred or killed the first female mathematician. One of the earliest female mathematicians got martyred. bar them, dragged them to church and killed, I think in Alexandria. I have to remember, I can't remember who she was, and what she did, but they were a pretty brutal bunch, the Christians would have wiped this out, and then the Arabs come up and it rebirths. Even right, okay, thanks to Simplus, Luther's transcription, we appear to have the entire of Parmenides' major metaphysical arguments demonstrating the attributes of what is on eon or true reality, altheica. So what does that earth mean? So it's getting complicated. So this is ancient archaeology of a culture interfering with a culture, looking at the transmission of ideas. So this is not freely done, and you can see nowadays we have a culture interacting with ideas. Certain ideas can't get through, and there's cultural things, cultural implications. It's also interesting that you're listening to a podcast on this, which is not a legitimate form of getting information in our world, but back in their world, listening to a poem was the only method of getting things out. We are much less informed about the cosmology of Parmenides. So this is his idea of heaven, earth, and space. It's found in the later part of the poem and must so supplement the primary evidence of the fragments with testimonium. That is, with the various reports of paraphrases his theories, so that we find that we also find in later authors. A number of the testimonia are collected among the 54 La Fragmenti in the Parmenides section of Diels and Krantz de Fragment de Volscrater. A more comprehensive collection of the testimony with English translations is found by Coxon, 2009. So this is all together. So basically we've got, it's sort of like finding about the Titanics. We've got, the movie, and we've got the Reader's Digest, and we're trying to best stick those two things together. And of course, and we've got a bit of the archaeology, sort of deep diving. We've dived into it, and we've got a picture of him, like tickets of it. We're trying to reconstruct it. There's a fascination with it, and there's evidence that people had a long time didn't care about. Certainly, the partial and imperfect preservation of his poem is one factor that complicates understanding of his thought. Look, this is like an Agatha Christie murder mystery. It's not simple. I just want to draw your attention to the world around you, the people being totally intolerant. This is by the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. This is real. What I'm talking to you, every fact is true, yet you will find people around you who are very hostile to looking at what's going on. And this hostility is live archaeological evidence of your particular world coming in. Okay, we're 38 minutes in. 2, overview of Parmenides' poem. Now she was, I have got to, there was something I had to remember. Just bear with me as I go back. Yeah, I was trying to, Sorry about this. Negative Essentials by Bertrand Russell. There you go. Sorry, this is an overview. I'm doing cognitive rehab and just stretching my memory in different ways. Okay. So, overview, so this is Negative Essentials by Bertrand Russell. 2, overview of Parmenides' poem, the proem. So this is the leading into a poem. Now, you've got to put aside your prejudice against poetry. And you've got to put aside the fact that you may not have heard the fact that Newton and other people, everyone, produced poems, especially in that stage. So it was okay. And you've put aside the fact that people who are experts in poetry and know certain things like Wordsworth and a few things like that, put that aside, the fact that they are experts and I'm not an expert in poetry, I'm just reading it across here. One of the important things I have to do to link poetry and scientists is that a interaction between Reverend Wewald, who is the minder of Faraday. I've forgotten what Faraday's first name is. Far out. But he had an argument with a poet, and the poet said, what's this thing you're talking about? And so he invented the word scientist, and they won the word scientist and things like that defined. So poets have actually defined the modern idea of a scientist as a poetic hero. The hero of Victorian poems is a scientist. And there's so much fictionalization, culture of the scientist. But even those people will be very aggressive to you and not give you any time of day. But that's the fact. So let's listen to this, the poem. Parmenides' poem began with a proem, P-R-O-E-M, describing a journey he figuratively once made to the abode of a goddess. So this is a film script within a film script. This is the actual film script, but Socrates, Plato, is writing a film script about his... Oh, this is just too complicated. Okay, he described how he was conveyed on a far-fabled path of divinity in a chariot by teams of mares, and how the maiden daughters of Helios, the sun, sun god, led the way. So this chariot turned up, had limos wound up, and look at this, there's female horses and female, we used to call it in the 80s stunt chicks, these good looking women who were put around cars or something like that. These maidens take Parmenides to whence they themselves have come. Come back to our place, to the, quote, the hall of the night, N-I-G-H-T, so this is the night sky. Therefore we, before which stands, quote, the gates of the path of night and day. Okay, so what's understanding here is that religion has now moved into government and something like that. It's religion is like a police station. It's a service. You go up and they check a law system. You're in or out. You can do it. You can exchange. It's like a commercial entity. Back then, religion was had a function of philosophical understanding. People would discuss things and they wouldn't burn you. Before which stands, okay, the maidens gently persuade justice. Hey, this is like a Marvel hero, justice, guardian of these gates, to open them so that Parmenides himself may pass through the abode with him. Parmenides thus describes how the goddess who dwells there are welcome upon his arrival. And the goddess received me kindly, and into her hand she took my right hand, and she spoke and addressed me thus, O young man, accompanied by immortal charioteers and mares who you bear you as you arrive at our abode. Welcome, since a fate by no means ill sends you ahead to travel this way, for surely it is far from the track of humans, right, but right and justice. Okay, so this is as whack a poem as you can possibly get. Now, I should, at this stage, even then, people have come past and said, what the heck are you doing? Oh, bloody stupid. Looking at this, oh, they're out of date. Why are you looking at this? Why are you looking at this after doing the World Atlas of Cheese? You're completely mad. Well, let's be mad together and go across. So, this dude has written this poem. And in this poem, he has the first section that he's talking about, which is a chariot arrives for him with these beautiful maidens and female horses, and they take him up to this pad up in the sky, in the heaven. And this pad has this beautiful woman called, what's her name? Justice. And she says, "Oh, you are just, you've got something. You've got some swag." Parry's poem is no epistemological allegory of enlightenment, but a topographical specific description of a mystical journey to the halls of night. I.e., there is no philosophy here, guys. Move on. This is just getting us into the frame. It's just an introduction. In his sod, the horrible dwelling of the night, is where the goddess of night and day alternatively resides as their other traverses the sky above earth. What the heck? So this is a good night. They say, oh, shit. It's now daytime and I'm going, oh, this is complex. So I'm a girl and it's day, so at night time I can go into the good palace, otherwise I go into this hovel called Hesod. Oh god, this is complicated. Both the pyramids and Hesod's conception of this place. Oh, in Hesod. Okay, so Hesod is not a place. Hesod is another philosopher, and he says it's a horrible place. Okay, so there's Parmenides and Hesod. That's wrong. And Hesod believes this is horrible. So this is place with it. Scratch that. They stay there all the time. But you've got the Parmenides who thinks it's a swag place, and Hesod who thinks it's a dump. Both Parmenides and Hesod's conception of this place have their precedent in the Babylonian mythology of the sun god's abode. Alright. Okay, so we're talking about really ancient stuff. This abode was traditionally served as a place of judgment, and this fact tends to confirm when Parmenides' goddess tells him that no ill fate has sent him ahead to this place, she is indicating that he has miraculously reached the place to which travel the souls of the dead. So you've got Greek mythology, and there are these different mythologies, and there's none of this religious scholasticism which says, you believe that, you can't believe that. You know, these people are pretty unhassled. So what's happening is that he's a Greek person, they think he's the son of Apollo, but he thinks that the Babylonian theory of cosmology is okay. So the Greeks themselves don't have... Oh dear. In this poem, then, Parmenides casts himself in the role of an initiate into the kind of mysteries that were, during his day, the religious milieu of Magna Graecia. So this is how to quite understand that these people were put out. The Greek ships would sail away for months into storms. You never know if you see them again. Then you have all these things, and they're trying to work things out. And there's no big religious system telling them what to think. So they just pick anything they want. The motif of the initiate is important, for it informs Parmenides' portrayal of himself as one whose encounters with major divinity has yielded special knowledge or wisdom, which is the fundamental thing of the cult leader. He was a cult leader saying, "Hey, I'm running a show, well, because I was lucky enough to be picked up by this chariot, blah, blah, blah." So you can see. So there's this very similar thing if you look at Pythagoras. The divinity in this instance would seem to be Night herself. Parmenides goes to the halls of... Night, and the goddess who greets him welcomes him to our home. The goddess Night serves as a counselor to Zeus in some of the major Orphic cosmologies, including Derveni cosmology. So what we believe in the Roman version of Greek mythology was far more complex. So a Roman volume is Juno with a ramified all the Greek gods. God, this is, does he hit him? In the closely related Orphic rhapsodies, Knight instructs Zeus on how to preserve the unity produced by his absorption of all things in himself and sets about initiating a new cosmological phase. It is thus appropriate that Knight should be the source of Parmenides' revelation, for Parmenidean metaphysics is very much concerned with the principle of unity in the cosmos. So you can see that really this is on the verge of being the philosophy is their religion at this point in time. So the Orphic rhapsodies. So rather than being a distinct religion, they've got difference of the very ancient Babylonian things and this afterlife, and you've got to really understand that all these people believed 100% in the superstition. The superstitious world. So, now you may reject it as rubbish at this point in time, but this is the rubbish that our civilization has been built on. Thanks for listening. I'll get on to my next section very soon. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.